people talk about the Arctic being the canary in the coal mine, their metaphor being it's the region of the planet that people expected to undergo change first, and in the metaphor the canary dies because it's being asphyxiated in the coal mine, and that's a good clue that you as a human being should leave before you also die. Well, the trouble is that kind of the Arctic canary in the climate system already seems to be on its last legs, and we get that message of the canary dying because of observations, not because of models. So the last decade, the general trend in the scientific community is one of surprise at the rate at which we see the Arctic changing.
Welcome to Climate Radio, back with a new monthly show after a three-year hiatus. We start the series with a no-holds-barred look at the current state of the science, focusing in on the latest observations of change in the Arctic. We bring you the views of two senior scientists who both gave evidence to the recent Environment Audit Committee inquiry into protecting the Arctic. First, here's Professor Peter Wadhams, head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge University.
Amongst many other things, you've been involved in measuring the Arctic sea ice for the last 40 years. Can you tell us what we know with certainty about how the Arctic sea ice has changed over that time?
We started working about 40 years ago when the British Navy first started sending submarines to the Arctic. I went along to measure ice thickness, and initially it was a matter of establishing just what the ice thickness distribution was. So the assumption was that it was always going to be the same. But nobody knew what it was, so we were able to establish what the shape of the distribution function was, how many pressure ridges there were, how many of them were deep ridges. All of these pretty important things we were able to set up and understand through the use of Navy data. But after a while, it became clear that things were changing, and there was a big difference, for instance, between measurements that I made in 1976 and measurements that I made in 1987, 11 years later, traveling along the same tracks in the Arctic. We found that the ice thickness was about 15% less in 1987. So I published a paper on that, and it really was the first paper on thinning of ice in the Arctic, the first detection of ice thinning. And since then, the Americans have published a lot more because they have more data than we have, and I've published some more as well. And we've found that the 15% in the 1980s has turned into more than 40% in the by the end of last century. The average thickness of the ice in the Arctic is now only slightly more than half what it was 30 years ago. That's a massive change, and it's a change which is greater than the rate of change just due to steady retreat. I mean, it was known from satellite imagery, where you can very clearly see the area of ice in the Arctic, that the ice was retreating, and it was retreating fairly slowly at just a few percent per decade. And the assumption was that that would continue, and gradually the ice would retreat, and by perhaps the end of this century, we might be seeing an ice-free Arctic in the summer. But what those analyses didn't take account of was the fact that the ice was very rapidly thinning as well. And once we'd found this thinning rate from submarine data, it was clear that the retreat rate would be bound to accelerate. It couldn't just continue to retreat slowly, because it was thinning so fast that we would reach the point very soon where the winter growth would be more than offset by the summer melt, and the whole ice cover would just collapse. And I was predicting that this would be happening round about 2016, something like that, and that was generally ridiculed, but in fact it started to happen, and this year was a case where half of the remaining ice went, and the present trend really does point towards a disappearance of the Arctic summer sea ice by about 2016.
Okay. So what are we combining what we know about the reduction in area and the reduction in thickness? What reduction in volume have we had over that 40-year period,
Oh,
do you
we've had
think?
a reduction in volume of about 70%.
Right.
So, if combining the thickness and area, and if we compare the summer sea ice volume with what we had in the 1980s, we're now down to 30% of that figure. So it's a very, very, very serious retreat.
Okay, during the hearings for the Environment Audit Committee, the Met Office Chief Scientist, Professor Julia Slingo, wasn't ha going to go with your 75%. She at that point she said she was awaiting the cryosat to satellite measurements, but they've come in now, haven't they? And what were they telling about
Well,
the
the cryosat
thickness of
measurements
the
that
ice?
were being done by the late Seymour Laxon agreed with my predictions, and they found, even though Cryosat was only operating for the last year or so because it's a new satellite, they found a very large decrease in area and, well, not only area but thickness during the past year, which agreed with my measurements and predictions, and they so in fact Slingo was completely off beam because she was trying to think as a government scientist, come up with some complacent view about what was happening that wouldn't upset, wouldn't frighten the horses. And so because the observations from submarines were showing this massive decrease in volume, which would lead inevitably to a complete loss of summer sea ice in 3 or 4 years' time, she was forced to resort to saying, well, we must look at other sources of data, and the only other source of data that hadn't yet turned in a result was this new satellite, Cryosat. So she said, well, we must wait for the satellite results. But Cryosat has come up with results and has come up with the same results as I've had, a rapid thinning. And so really, she is left without a leg to stand on as far as that's concerned, that the Cryosat data agrees with the submarine data, and both of them point towards a very rapid destruction of the summer sea ice. So she really should be withdrawing her previous statements, but she hasn't.
What explains some of these discrepancies in predictions for a summer Arctic free of ice? Is it due to the fact that the people with dates that are much further in the future are relying on models, and you're much more relying
Yes,
on
I think that's the problem. It's
observation?
excessive reliance on models, and you usually find that modelers are people who've never been to the Arctic, and therefore what they put into the model is not the complete physics of what goes on in Arctic processes in summer or winter. For instance, the climate models used by the Met Office neglect a lot of factors which people who actually work in the Arctic are aware are important. One, for instance, is the fact that with the ice retreating so fast, you now have such a large open water area in summer that it's generating a lot of wave action. You really have an ocean with waves present, and that wave action eats away at the remaining ice by causing it to break up into ice floes, and the ice floes melt rapidly. So it causes an increased rate of retreat of the existing ice because of the action of the waves. That's a process that's not included in models. It's a process which is actually being studied in a field program that we're carrying out at the moment together with US researchers, and we hope to come up with some results on that soon. Other processes relate to the way in which, as the ice rots away in summer, it forms a network of rotted ice floes with melt pools running through into the water below, which have a reduced albedo, that they absorb a lot more solar radiation, and that causes them to rot away and melt more rapidly than is predicted by models. So there's a number of different factors relating to what people see on the ground, which ought to be included in models and aren't. So it's actually scientifically dishonest to point to a model saying the model predicts nothing will happen for the next 20, 30, 40 years, when the model itself doesn't include all the physics.
Yeah, so the observations are outstripping the kind of modelling.
Yes, the observations are outstripping the concepts of the modellers. Mm. So you have to go with the observations. And I think it was Feynman, the famous physicist Richard Feynman, said that if you have observations and measurements, and you have a model, and the observations disagree with the model, you have to go with the observations, not with the model.
Mm-hmm. So the Environment Audit Committee ended up concluding that there is new evidence that the Arctic ice is thinning faster than previously thought, and they said that therefore the general view that ice cap is not at risk of summer collapse in the next few years may need to be revisited and revised. But the government, when they responded to the Environment Audit Committee's report, rejected that idea. What do you make of the rationale that the government gave for rejecting that idea?
Well, there's no rationale. I mean, the government response was extremely dispiriting, because they could have written that response before the Environmental Audit Committee came up with its report. I mean, it was a very hard-hitting report, a very good report. It was really looking at two separate but related areas regarding Arctic sea ice. One was this rapid retreat, which will lead to completely different conditions in the Arctic, and the other was concerned with the fact that we don't understand what will happen if we have an oil blowout under ice, and since we don't know how to cope with or deal with an oil blowout, we should be very cautious about undertaking drilling in the Arctic until we know how to get rid of any oil that's spilled under ice. Those were the two areas in which the Environmental Audit Committee made strong representations in their report. They were both completely ignored by the government. I mean, the government response was absolutely pathetic thing. It was just a standard bureaucratic, mindless response, saying everything's okay, we're fulfilling international criteria, we're following what everybody else is doing, we're doing the right things, nothing special needs to be done, all this kind of stuff. So you sort of felt, well, the Environmental Audit Committee went to all this trouble conducting hearings, listening to scientists, trying to understand what was going on, presenting a report. The government had no interest whatever in it. And you can see that, therefore, the government's purely governed by the question of short-term financial interests. Their whole apparent concern with the global climate issues is completely fraudulent.
If we can look at the other kind of processes, natural systems that are in flux in the Arctic, what's happening, what's the current situation with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which the Environment Committee also looked at as a potential kind of tipping point?
Again, this year was an unprecedented year in the sense that until about 1985, there really was no summer melt detectable in the Greenland ice sheet. It continued to grow and throughout the year. And then in 1985, there was the first evidence of some melt on the surface during the summer months. And then this gradually grew to the point where more and more of the surface was showing some kind of summer melt. So that there was a net contribution by the Greenland ice sheet over the year to the ocean. There was a net loss of ice, which was helping to increase global sea level rise. That's got steadily more intense. And this year, for the very first time, pretty much the entire ice sheet was covered with meltwater in the summer, and 97% of the surface, in fact. And what this means is that you're getting more and more superficial melt in the summer. The water is running down through holes in the ice sheet to the bedrock interface and causing glaciers to accelerate, which is giving you an increased rate of emission of ice from Greenland in the form of icebergs. And the result is really that Greenland's now the single biggest contributor to global sea level rise of all the regions where glacier melt is putting water into the ocean. And if you assume that the Greenland contribution is going to steadily grow, then we ought to be revising upwards our estimates of the rate of sea level rise this century. At the moment, policymakers tend to be governed by the previous predictions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who took account only of the warming of the ocean, which gives you a sea level rise in itself, but ignored the contribution of ice sheet melt. And they were predicting somewhere between 30 and 60 centimetres of sea level rise this century, based purely on warming of the ocean. But if you include the contribution from glaciers and ice sheets, especially the Greenland ice sheet, the result is going to come to more than a metre, maybe substantially more than a metre this century. And that's really quite important, because although it doesn't seem a lot, if you move the mean by that value, it means that the probability of extreme values, like extreme storm surges in the Bay of Bengal, which give you flooding in Bangladesh, those are going to be greatly increased. We're going to have a lot more disastrous floods in vulnerable parts of the world which can't afford to build up their flood defences, like Bangladesh or eastern China. And so we must be aware that this Greenland ice sheet melt is going to have serious consequences for the world.
Moving on to the various sources of methane emissions that could potentially be released in the Northern Hemisphere and the Arctic in particular.
Yes, there's two sources of methane that could be very serious in the Arctic. Methane content in the atmosphere has been rising very rapidly over the past many years, but flattened off at the end of last century, and we've had about 10 years of fairly flat methane levels. Then it started to rise again in the last two or three years. And one of the sources, which is potentially the most frightening, is that as the sea ice retreats in the summer and gives you a lot of open water, the open water over the continental shelves, which are very wide, about one third of the Arctic Ocean is continental shelf, and the open water over that shelf is warmed up by the solar heating during the summer if there's no sea ice present, and satellites are showing temperatures of up to about 7 degrees being reached in the Arctic, in the fringes of the Arctic Ocean. This is something like the North Sea in winter. And those warm temperatures cause the seabed to melt. The seabed is at the moment frozen as a relic of the last ice age. You have subsea permafrost. But if you warm up the seabed, because the sea ice has retreated from the ocean overhead, then you're releasing all the material that's trapped under the seabed, and that includes a lot of methane. So there's observations that have been made by summer expeditions into the Arctic Ocean are showing huge plumes of methane gas being released from the seabed and bubbling up to the surface. And that will give an increase in methane concentrations in the atmosphere and an acceleration of global temperature rise, because methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. The other process, which is slower but actually potentially much bigger in terms of total volume release, is the entire area of the Arctic land masses, that's Alaska, Siberia, that are covered at the moment with permafrost. The permafrost, which is frozen ground under the surface, is melting because of global warming, and you're getting an active layer at the surface that used to be frozen all the time, but is now melted part of the year. And that's producing new methane by working on the rotted organic vegetation, which was frozen into the permafrost, but is now dissolving in the water that's released. And so it is a sort of a bog effect, which is producing methane gas. This is a smaller quantity of methane per unit area than the offshore permafrost, but a vastly greater area. So we can expect a big, long-lasting contribution to methane content in the atmosphere from the melting of Arctic permafrost. And between them, the permafrost melt, which is a big but slow process, and the offshore permafrost melt, which is a smaller but more rapid process, are both going to be adding considerably to the rate of global temperature rise. And so we really have to consider that the global warming rate in the future is not just going to be governed by our carbon dioxide emissions, but by the methane emissions that are coming out of the Arctic.
And again, it seems like these processes are poorly understood and have yet to be integrated properly into models. So on the thermohaline overturning current.
Thermohaline circulation. That's something that I've worked on directly because... Okay. The overturning circulation depends on sinking of seawater at high latitudes, and the two regions where that happens are the Labrador Sea and the Greenland Sea. And we've worked extensively in the Greenland Sea, where the overturning has diminished very significantly in recent years. And the reason is that it depends on the winter growth of sea ice in a region of the Greenland Sea, which is where ice doesn't come down into it from the Arctic, but it grows locally because of a cold current. And this rapid growth of ice locally produces an increase in the density of the surface water because of salt rejected by the ice that's forming. And this produces very deep-reaching convection in the form of chimneys. That's a chimney is a kind of rotating cylinder of sinking water that can reach down from the surface to about 2,500 meters. And we spent a number of years observing, measuring chimneys in the Greenland Sea, and found that towards the end of that time, the numbers of chimneys was going down. And the reason was that the ice wasn't forming in that area in the winter anymore because of global warming. And so the driver for the sinking is ice formation. And if ice formation ceases, then there won't be the sinking, there won't be the chimney formation. And that cuts out one of the driving mechanisms for the thermohaline circulation. So we reckon the thermohaline circulation will become weaker, and that has been put into models. It's one of the things that has been, and it comes out with predictions that although that will result in some cooling of the North Atlantic, or at least a lesser rate of warming of the North Atlantic, so that. By the end of the century, Europe can be, on the whole, will be getting something like a 4-degree rise in temperature. That's a very serious temperature rise. But Britain will only get about a 2-degree rise because of Britain sits in the Atlantic stream of water from the Gulf of Mexico, and because that's cooling, there'll be an offset to our rate of global warming. So in a sense, the weakening of the thermohaline circulation will benefit Britain in that it will reduce our rate of warming and give us maybe a 2-degree warming in this century rather than 4 degrees, which would be a pretty drastic rise.
Right. So all these different processes combined, and the fact that they appear to be changing faster than the models have been predicting, What can we draw as a conclusion about, you know, what we've been relying on up until now about the rate of change of global climate and global warming?
Well, I think it's a very serious warning that we have to do something drastic and do it soon. Because, for instance, we know that already the amount of warming that has happened in the world is such that if we don't emit a single molecule more of carbon dioxide, we'll still be committed to a total warming of more than 2 degrees from the pre-industrial level. I mean, this shows that the politicians who talk about keeping warming below 2 degrees are all basically lying, because they know, and the scientists know, that although the total amount of global warming has not yet reached 2 degrees, it's committed into the system. And because warming in the Arctic is much faster than the rest of the world, there's an amplification factor of about 3. That means we're going to get about 6 degrees of warming in the Arctic, and that's enough to cause very large methane emissions from land and from offshore, which means a further acceleration of global warming. So we're stuck with an accelerated global warming rate, even if we weren't emitting any more carbon dioxide. So what we're facing really is a global catastrophe. So all the ideas that people have had about geoengineering, where they try to directly influence climate by putting aerosols into the atmosphere or whitening clouds, these geoengineering techniques, they sound crazy, they sound sort of frightening, they sound as if they might be making matters worse. But in fact, I think they're our last hope to actually avoid a runaway global warming for the planet as a whole.
Obviously, the Environmental Audit Committee was proposing caution when it came to geoengineering, that they concluded further research is needed to understand how such techniques work and their wider impacts on climate systems. What kind of would be a sensible position for the global community to take on geoengineering, bearing in mind the various risks you've mentioned?
Yes, well, I think they're right to say further research is needed. You shouldn't plunge into some global experiment with releasing all kinds of strange aerosols into the atmosphere without having to research the consequences first. But what that means is that the research that's needed should be undertaken as a very, very high priority. We should make it perhaps the highest priority of all the sort of research needs of that we should be doing in the world, should be to look at every possible proposed technique of geoengineering and both model and experimentally observe what will happen if we try them, and come up as quickly as possible with some conclusions about which methods will work and which methods won't.
How widespread would you say, finally, were your views amongst your colleagues who have been involved in observing the Arctic and are kind of aware of these kind of issues? Would you say that your views were shared widely, or there's suspicion or caution?
Well, I think they're shared pretty widely by the community of Arctic scientists who actually work in the Arctic, as opposed to modellers. But it's also shared by some modellers, the modellers who actually have the best models, the highest resolution models, where they've included all the possible physical processes in the model. They're coming up with results which predict these rapid consequences, and they're as concerned as the field people are. So I think there's getting to be a consensus of deep concern about Arctic processes. At the more complacent end of the spectrum, I think, are the sort of government scientists who are using the older models, which don't include all these physics, and they can, they're the ones who can come up with these very complacent statements, which really fly in the face of observations.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams, head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge University. For a second view on developments in the Arctic, we spoke to Professor Timothy Lenton, the award-winning chair in climate change and Earth System Science at University of Exeter.
I mean, in your evidence to the Environment Audit Committee, you expressed a view that the Arctic might be the first region of a larger scale that may be experiencing dangerous climate change. Can you explain why you think that?
Yes, sure. So I think the Arctic is arguably showing us dangerous climate change because the change in terms of, for example, the sea ice cover has accelerated markedly, and there's been, for example, a kind of abrupt and persistent increase in the extent of summer sea ice loss in 2007 and since then, which might arguably be described as some kind of tipping point for the sea ice, especially if it doesn't revert back to the normal kind of annual cycle of variability. And because the implications of this sea ice loss associated warming being about twice the global average, if not more, are starting to impact on ecosystems and on the communities living there in a fairly obvious and measurable way, and generally detrimental way, I think.
There's a range of views about when the Arctic might be ice-free in the summer. Mm. Has your view changed since the cryostat 2 data has come in this year? Which was kind of seemed to be quite an accurate measure of thickness and backing up a data set by the University of Washington.
My personal guess is that the summer sea ice on the current downward trend, which is kind of non-linear accelerating, if you extrapolate it forwards, my guess is the Arctic summer sea ice will be lost sometime in the 2030s, but I wouldn't rule out it happening sooner. I certainly think that the new data getting information on ice thickness and therefore overall volume is really helpful in trying to understand the system. Our suspicion is that in 2007, when we saw the flushing out of the Arctic basin of lots of the older so-called multi-year ice that's thicker, since then the ice has sort of changed into a different regime where it's mostly ice that just formed last winter, so it's it's younger and also thinner, and it can melt away over a much larger extent and more rapidly each summer. And I think this is a new regime, if you like, for the sea ice, and a worrying one, and it's hastening its demise, if you like.
Right. I'm kind of curious that you said the 2030s for an Arctic ice-free summer in your evidence to the Environment Audit Committee, but I'm surprised that, as I say, that the new data that's come in about the thickness from cryostat hasn't changed your view. If you plot a volume graph and the way that's been declining, it does appear to be kind of exponential.
True. Yeah. I mean, my extrapolation to the 2030s is from fitting a quadratic trend to the current data, admittedly for the ice coverage rather than the volume, because we have a long data set for that, and we've studied that satellite data set in exhaustive detail in the last year and a half or so, just trying to understand what's happened in the ice dynamics recently in terms of this apparent abrupt increase in summer ice loss. I haven't gone back and incorporated the thickness data at such a level of detail into the analysis, so I'm only not adjusting my figures because I haven't had the time to bring that new information into a formal analysis. So I'm obviously quite open to revising that, and I would basically say I wouldn't take my estimate of when the summer ice will be lost as a definitive one in any sense. Okay. Well, it will go when it goes, if you know what I mean. I think it's perhaps more important to think about what the consequences are of the the accelerating retreat that we are already seeing. Mm.
I guess one of those impacts would be the loss of albedo, the loss of reflective capacity.
Yeah,
which increases warming at the North Pole. And it's also impacting on Greenland ice melt. I wonder if you could say something about those two things.
Yeah, so when you have record ice loss of the sea ice in the Arctic, you therefore expose a dark ocean surface. This leads to more sunlight being absorbed by the ocean, and the ocean has a considerable heat capacity, so it can store quite a bit of that heat, and generally that warms the region it wants. So we're warming the water, but also the lower atmosphere, and we're seeing those ice retreats correlate with warmth over the Greenland ice sheet and some record melt on the Greenland ice sheet surface during 2012, for example. There's a little bit of what's the chicken, what's the egg here, because earlier in 2012 there's a very unusual weather pattern, if you like, putting warm air over the whole of Greenland and causing all of the surface to be melting at the same time for the first time that's been ever seen. And that warm air coming over is all part of an interconnected system, can also go on and contribute to what became the record sea ice loss this summer. So as ever with the Earth system or the climate system, it's highly interconnected and not always sensible to talk about who's driving who, but the overall pattern is clearly with the ice loss, it adds to regional warming, and that's surely contributing to the Greenland ice sheet melt. And it's already changing, as one would expect, atmospheric pressure and wind patterns and the overall circulation of the atmosphere in the northern hemisphere.
Is it fair to say that the Greenland ice sheet melt is has been poorly understood until recently in observation, and is kind of filling us in on some of what's happening there now, and we're starting to understand it better. So perhaps the models have not properly been incorporating what might be happening in Greenland into the models adequately.
Yeah, the Greenland ice sheet is a kind of crucial tipping element in the climate system, because if it starts going into irreversible meltdown, it eventually can give up to 6 or 7 metres of sea level rise. I say eventually because it really depends how much you warm it, how quickly you can melt it. But our understanding of that system has not been very complete, and it's improving quite a lot at the moment. The idea of a threshold for melt of the Greenland ice sheet was originally framed in terms of basically when is there more melt at the surface of the ice sheet averaged over the year than incoming snowfall. But actually that's a rather conservative or more distant way of estimating the threshold, because at the moment you also have the ice sheet losing mass by breaking off icebergs into the water surrounding it, with parts of the ice sheet sticking its icy fingers out into the ocean. And the latest work published last year was revising the proximity of this threshold for irreversible meltdown of the ice sheet to somewhere in the range of, I think, 0.8 to 3.2 degrees of warming above pre-industrial, and we're already at more than 0.8 degrees of warming above pre-industrial, so we're already in this error range for possible triggering this possible meltdown of Greenland. The other thing that's happened is scientists who've gone up on the surface of the ice sheet and been looking intensively at the satellite data as well have started to get a better understanding of the processes of surface melt, for example. And it would appear that in the summer, as you begin to age the snow and melt some of the surface, this changes its albedo or reflectivity in a way that contributes to further melt. So that became very clear this year, last year in 2012, when we had this unusual warm air causing melting across the whole ice sheet and fairly early on in the summer, if you like. That then seemed to measurably altered the surface reflectivity in a way that actually then contributed to more absorption of sunlight and more melting through the summer. And on top of that, we're trying to get our head round as scientists how the ice flow, so it's like ice seems like a solid, but it's very sort of slowly flowing almost fluid. How that flow, and especially the flushing out of ice as glaciers, how that might be sensitive to changes in the surface melt. The meltwater that's pooling and ponding on the surface, ultimately often disappearing down cracks into the ice sheet. New work is starting to get a better handle on where that meltwater goes and whether it can actually accelerate ice loss or not, or contribute to carving off of the icebergs. And there's some evidence that it does, although it's quite sort of seasonally variable in its behaviour. Sea level rise is a complicated thing, it turns out, when it comes from ice sheets at least, in that the contribution to sea level is not evenly distributed around the world. So in the case, it happens to be on the opposite side of the planet to the ice sheet, where you get the largest effects. So the Greenland contribution to sea level is going to be felt on the more on the opposite side of the planet at the moment, interestingly. So maybe impacting bits of the southern Pacific region, small islands around there. And then the ice sheet melts. It's a source of fresh water into these waters surrounding Greenland, and that generally makes those surface waters less dense, and that could make some contribution towards making those surface waters less inclined to undergo convection and sinking to the bottom of the ocean, which happens both to the west of Greenland in the Labrador Sea and to the east in the Greenland, Iceland, Norwegian seas at the moment. Now, interestingly, the Labrador Sea, so-called deep convection area, which is fueling part of the ocean's great so-called conveyor belt or thermohaline circulation, that Labrador Sea convection's quite a volatile beast anyway. It's switched on and off within the last few decades. So there's quite a lot of interest in understanding how important could the Greenland ice melt be to disrupting the Atlantic overturning circulation.
Right. I wondered to what extent you would agree there might be a pattern emerging about observation outstripping what we can model, and a lot of the time that these processes seem to be unfolding faster than models have predicted.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Phil. I think that the lesson that the Arctic, people talk about the Arctic being the canary in the coal mine, their metaphor being it's the region of the planet that people expected to undergo change first, and to, in the metaphor, the canary dies because it's being asphyxiated in the coal mine, and that's a good clue that you as a human being should leave before you also die. Well, the trouble is kind of the Arctic canary in the climate system already seems to be on its last legs, and we get that message of the canary dying because of observations, not because of models. So the last decade, the general trend in the scientific community is one of surprise at the rate at which we see the Arctic changing. At the same time, we're putting up more detailed monitoring and getting more and more information highlighting this abrupt change. So yeah, I think it's a sort of shift in the scientific paradigm, definitely in a good way, that the observations in a sense are starting to lead the models, and obviously deeply question the models in the case of the Arctic, because our models for future projection are still not able to capture the rate of observational loss of, for example, the sea ice in the Arctic. So that means we're missing some crucial feedbacks that exist within the climate system, within the Arctic system, that seem to amplify forcing from human activities and cause more rapid change than we're able to capture in our models. So it's a great case where of observation-led science forcing a revision of our understanding in terms of mechanisms and in terms of models going on.
Okay. final kind of tipping point that the Environment Audit Committee focused in on particularly was the Arctic methane, which seemed to be a lot of
that old chestnut. Yeah.
Yeah, a wide variety of views on, but also new observations coming in all the time.
So my take on the unfolding story in the Arctic is, as we've just been discussing, we should really focus on some extraordinary observational signals or trends that are happening now. And if I was to look at something to be wanting to do more research on, it would be the link that seems to be unfolding between the summer or the Arctic ice loss and movements of the jet stream in mid-latitudes, which happens to have profound impacts for the weather in the UK and lots of other regions around similar latitudes. Because it looks to me, and to several scientists, there's some connection between the unusual southward shift of the jet stream through 2012, for example, with the record ice loss in the Arctic. That happened to be, in that case, associated with summer and with a particularly wet and miserable year, in record-breaking wet year in England, and almost record-breaking in the UK. But of earlier cold winters, like 2009, 2010, seem also to have some correlation to changes in the Arctic, although many other factors are contributing. But if this is real, it's changing the pattern of extreme events in regions like the UK, where there are massive implications for the insurance industry, for example, and worrying trends of insurance being withdrawn from flooding householders in the UK, for example. I would say that that's a very real and immediate issue to try and understand. There is a separate issue scientifically about whether the warming of the Arctic is going to lead to an awful lot of release of methane, which is clearly an important greenhouse gas and would add somewhat to global warming. All the data I've seen and the information I've looked at suggests that, yes, warming the Arctic region is leading to some more release of methane from frozen reservoirs, either in the frozen soils that are melting or under the shelf seas. When adding the numbers up or doing the calculations, currently the contribution this extra methane makes to global warming is small. It's around the sort of 1% amplification of overall warming kind of level. Other people are arguing this is a massive danger, a massive worry. Implicitly what they're saying is this could amplify warming by 100% or something more of that order. And I personally think I haven't seen any calculations from them to back up that statement yet. So I will stick with the numbers, my calculations I have, and I don't want to kind of be... I think it's a concern, but I don't think it's the most immediate one or necessarily the most dangerous one at the moment, or even the most dangerous one in the long term.
Mm. Going back to the jet stream for a second,
yeah.
I know that the way that scientists are kind of looking and trying to understand how the jet stream is working and maybe changing with a warming Arctic is kind of complicated. But I wonder if there's a kind of nutshell that you can put it in with some kind of easy take-home messages for listeners.
Okay. In the simplest terms, the Arctic is warming up faster than the planet on average, and certainly quite a lot faster than the equator, thanks partly to the ice loss and the more absorption of sunlight by the darker ocean surface. So if the Arctic warms more than the equator, we have less of a temperature gradient from the warm equator to the coldness of the poles. This then affects essentially the positioning of crucial weather flows, if you like, or circulation of the atmosphere through the intervening middle latitudes or the whole of the northern hemisphere. It happens to be interfering with the positioning of what's known as the jet stream in the high atmosphere, but that also directs, for example, storms and weather systems across the North Atlantic. In some ways, it's causing more wiggle in this jet stream, and in summers seems to be contributing to southward movement to that jet. And it's essentially meaning that weather systems are going in a different place, and that has ramifications for the UK and all around the middle latitudes, right across Eurasia and North America. And it means that we sometimes can see a causal connection between the ice loss and some extreme weather events that happen through these mid-latitudes. And that, in a nutshell, saying is that the the climate's an interconnected system. You can't take away the ice cover at the North Pole and change the whole heat balance of that region without it causing knock-on effects through regions where many people live in the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, especially through the mid-latitudes.
These various changes that we're seeing in the Arctic will obviously have impacts on communities of humans as well as other kind of fauna and flora in the northern regions. What about also the implications for the speed and amount of global warming and the kind of estimates that the policymakers might currently be using? Are they all wildly out of whack with this new evidence coming in?
In general, we've seen a trend of observations putting actual climate change towards the upper end of the envelope of range of forecasts, and we should expect that if we continue business as usual, we're on the way to the upper end of future warming, at least maybe 4 degrees global average at the end of the century, if not more, and carrying on up from there.
Right. So finally, perhaps we can just get your view on geoengineering. Do you think that we should be kind of at least exploring that as an option?
I think that geoengineering, it's sad to say it, but it certainly warrants research to what it might be able to achieve. But I think geoengineering carries an awful lot of risks. I don't think we understand the climate system well enough to have high confidence in the impacts that would happen from, for example, a deliberate Arctic deployment of, say, aerosols in the stratosphere to try and cool just the Arctic. I mean, it's fairly obvious from what we've seen in the last decade of observations showing much more rapid and different changes to what models predicted that we can't be absolutely sure that whatever geoengineering does in a model would actually translate to what it would do in reality. And we know for sure that if you start geoengineering to cool things down, you commit not just yourself, but future generations to keep doing it, well, until we've tackled the underlying causes of warming, of the climate system, greenhouse gas build-up and certain warming aerosol emissions. So I have a couple of big reservations about talking seriously about geoengineering the Arctic, even though I'm deeply concerned about the changes that are going on in the Arctic. Still, I think there's something very concrete we can do, which is, for example, to try to mitigate the emissions of warming aerosols in the troposphere, in particular soot, black carbon as it's called, which in several studies would appear to be a key contributor to ice melt at times in the Arctic. Yeah, I think we should be very careful not to get scared into geoengineering when there are concrete things we should be doing first on mitigating the causes of Arctic warming. Mm.
Could we follow a dual track? Could we pursue both equally?
Undoubtedly, in principle, we could pursue a dual track of mitigating the causes of Arctic warming and engaging in some geoengineering. I personally would not advocate that.
The argument that Peter was giving was that there was 2 degrees C of warming kind of built in, even if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow. But obviously, therefore, he's saying we're at a dangerous level anyway. So even if we tackle fossil fuels and CO2, we do need something else to if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change.
Mm. The numbers as I have them are, I think, let's say globally we're about maybe 0.8, maybe pushing 0.9 of a degree warmer than pre-industrial, getting towards a degree warmer at the moment. And there is some committed warming, even if we froze the concentration of greenhouse gases at today's level, for example. That committed warming from the models is of the order of 0.6, 0.7 of a degree of warming. So my guesstimate is that we're currently at a committed warming of about 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial, and we haven't got a lot of room to play with before you get to the canonical 2 degrees of warming, but we're not quite there yet. Although within the range of error, we might be. I personally think 2 degrees of warming is an iconic figure in a sense a policy threshold, but it's not clear to me that it directly relates to any particular tipping point in the climate system. What concerns me more is that we could pass important tipping points conceivably before 2 degrees of global average warming, and in fact, arguably, maybe we already are in the Arctic, either for its sea ice or for the Greenland ice sheet, or for both. You know, we could see the loss of summer sea ice before we see globally average temperatures of 2 degrees, and we don't know, but we could have committed the Greenland ice sheet to considerable shrinkage before we reach 2 degrees.
Mm. I wonder if you've almost given a better argument for some kind of enhanced action than you might have been intending.
Well, I know, I realise that, and the reason I do research on geoengineering interventions at a global, typically I think about that at a global level, and in particular deliberate carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere, is because I know where we may be at or very close to the danger level. But before, most people when they talk about geoengineering are referring implicitly to so-called sunlight reflection methods, or they call it solar radiation management, basically methods of reflecting sunlight to cool the planet down. Personally, I think the lion's share of effort could go into removing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, if possible, that we've already added to the air. So as well as mitigating the emissions of carbon dioxide, we could get to work straight away on what's called carbon dioxide removal. And therefore, we're tackling the underlying cause of warming, the thing that long-term has to be tackled anyway. And that's where I would put the urgency of action.
I mean, I'm just wondering what kind of methods you're thinking of in terms of removing CO2.
We've been working in detail on methods of biomass energy with carbon capture and storage. That's simple stuff. We're already seeing a lot of afforestation in China to store carbon in biomass. And there's, of course, chemical and physical methods of carbon dioxide removal as well. They cost money, more perhaps than the biomass methods, but have perhaps less interactions with land use and issues of food security and so on.
You've been listening to an Arctic wake-up call on Climate Radio. Our thanks to Professors Peter Wadhams and Timothy Lenton. This programme is archived at climateradio.org, where you'll find references for the science in this show. Join us again next month, when we'll attempt to explore what might be adequate and appropriate responses to what the science is showing us.